translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. While following Krishna, Mother Yashoda, her thin waist overburdened by her heavy breasts, naturally had to reduce her speed. Because of following Krishna very swiftly, her hair became loose, and the flowers in her hair were falling after her. Yet she did not fail to capture her son, Krishna. Purport. Yogis cannot capture Krishna by severe penances and austerities, but Mother Yashoda, despite all obstacles, was finally able to catch Krishna without difficulty. This is the difference between a yogi and a bhakta. Yogis cannot enter even the effulgence of Krishna. Yasya prabha prabhavato jagat andhakoti kotishu, Brahma Samhita 540. In that effulgence, there are millions of universes, but yogis and jnanis cannot enter that effulgence even after many, many years of austerities, whereas bhaktas can capture Krishna simply by love and affection. This is the example shown here by Mother Yashoda. Krishna therefore confirms that if one wants to capture him, he must undertake devotional service. Muktiyamam abhijananti yavanyascha smitatvataha tato mam tatvato gyatva vishate tad anantaram. Bhagavad Gita 18:55. Bhaktas can enter even the planet of Krishna very easily, but the less intelligent yogis and jnanis, by their meditation, remain running after Krishna. Even if they enter Krishna's effulgence, they fall down. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Translation again. While following Krishna, Mother Yashoda, her thin waist overburdened by her heavy breasts, naturally had to reduce her speed. Because of following Krishna very swiftly, her hair became loose, and the flowers in her hair were falling after her. Yet she did not fail to capture her son, Krishna. This is the dramatic highlight of the conflict between Mother Yashoda and Krishna. She finally catches him after all this rascal behavior. And this verse shows she did not do so without difficulty. So this is very instructive for devotees, that Krishna is elusive, and it's not easy to be Krishna conscious. It is easy to practice, but it's hard to complete. And the difficulties that devotees undergo in devotional service are their, Prabhupada said, used the word, I believe it was metals. Like he cited the goring of the cow that he suffered in Vrindavan, or in Delhi rather, years ago. And the different difficulties that he went through. These were his ornaments. These were his battle scars. These were his stripes. This showed that he had paid his dues. In so many ways, you know, the Srila Prabhupada's humanness, the reality of his struggles and the things that he did. You know, he raised a family and he did business and he wrote and kept up his spiritual life during all of these difficult times. And then he never got discouraged. He said that about himself. I'm not one to be discouraged easily. You know, thank God. That is his quality. every devotee has to undergo difficult tests. You know, sometimes I reflect on the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, the first six chapters are about the Bhagavatam itself. That's the, sort of the introduction. But the last, especially the middle six or eight chapters, are the denouement, the completion of the Mahabharata, and tells what happens after the Battle of Kurukshetra. And, of course, there we see Krishna for the first time. I love that. You see Krishna for the first time there. Where do you see? Anyone remember? Where do we see Krishna for the first time in Srimad Bhagavatam? What's he doing? He's protecting. What's he doing with Arjuna? He's driving the chariot. So he's still there. It's just now what happens next. So in that first canto, Yudhisthira Maharaj is sort of the, indirectly, he's the central focus. And every chapter he's suffering. After the battle he's suffering. He's lamenting, oh, I have caused so many people to be killed, so many women have been made widows, so many children made orphans, just because of one man's desire to have a kingdom. Of course, we know that's completely unreasonable, but yet he felt that way, and he was genuinely depressed. So what did he do at that time? Yes, he went to consult Bhishma. And so Bhishma encouraged him and fortified him to take his responsibilities, right, and rule the kingdom. Even after the great battle, his grandson was threatened, and they were attacked again. You know, he went through all of that. Then he talked to Bhishma. Then he was ready. He ruled the kingdom. Then there's one chapter where he's happy. Anyone remember, what is that one chapter? It's the only chapter where Yudhisthira is happy from beginning to end. It's the birth of Maharaj Parikshit. And all of the great qualities of his grandson are described. And he's talking with the rishis, and he's going to be as honest as you, and all these superlative descriptions are made. So Yudhisthira is very happy. But then right after that, Dhritarashtra leaves home. And I mean, most of us would be happy if some elderly relative who was staying with us left home. But Yudhisthira was very depressed. He was he felt, again, responsible. Oh, I haven't treated him properly. Now he is left. And Gandhari and Vidura, they all left on me. So distraught. And Narada appears then, Narada Muni, to relieve his mind. And in the next chapter, he's worried, where's Arjuna? He's been gone so long. No email. No posting on Facebook. I haven't heard from him. He's all anxious. And then Arjuna comes completely distraught, devastated, tells him all the terrible news. And then Yudhisthira just leaves home immediately. So my point is that Yudhisthira suffers on and on again and again. And yet he is the emblem of Dharma. So the fact that devotees go through difficulties like Mother Yashoda is just part of devotional service. Srila Prabhupada cites a verse from a later chapter spoken by Lord Brahma, which he said should be the motto of all devotees. Anyone remember that verse? Can say it together, anyone who knows. Huh? Tate nukampam susumikshamano bunjana eva prakam prakam. Tad-vag-vapur-vir-viditam namaste jivete yat mukta pade sadayabak. Yes, the sufferings a devotee undergoes are received in three ways. First, a sense of responsibility, that I am suffering now because of what I have done in the past. This is the foundation of mental health, isn't it? To take responsibility for one's actions. It's very interesting in the 70s when the devotees in America sometimes would be kidnapped by family members and taken to professional psychologists to try to unbrainwash them. So the psychologist would say, it wasn't your fault you became a Hare Krishna. You were forced. You were brainwashed. You know, you're not responsible for this decision. Very hypocritical. So because it was so hypocritical, it didn't last. But the point is, the devotee always feels responsible. This is really important in personal relationships. You know, that when we are feeling uncomfortable or angry at somebody else, it's not them, it's us. You know, it's not that they are such bad people. And I'm from the southern United States, and down there you can say anything bad you want about another person. They're lazy, they're terrible, they're cheaters. I mean, as long as you end with, God bless them. That's what the people do down there. God bless them. So that's fine for the southerners. But for the devotees, that kind of attitude actually holds us back in advancement in Krishna consciousness. Tate nukampam susumikshamano. I am suffering because of what I have done. And this person is just a manifestation of my own sinful reactions. Not this person's actions, I should say. This very nice devotee, Peter Burwash, who's a professional motivational speaker, when he first took up Krishna consciousness, he was a struggling young athlete, and he was very excited about devotional service, raised $1,000 with difficulty, and gave it to the temple president to get a life membership. It was a lot of money for him and a big sacrifice. The next day, the temple president took the money and left. So he was quite affected by this, and he went to see Srila Prabhupada and told him what happened. So Prabhupada told him something which has to this day remained, he says, a cornerstone of his devotional life. Did anyone know what Prabhupada told him? He said, don't blame the agent of your karma. Don't blame the agent of your karma. So whatever we experience is only a result of what we have done in the past. This allows us to maintain a loving relationship with others, even if we don't approve of their actions. You know the old adage, if you point at somebody, you have three fingers pointing back at you, right? So therefore, when you're accusing somebody, it's important to point like this. Actually, it's important not to accuse others. The point is that when we are suffering at the hands of somebody else's actions, we take responsibility. This is the first stage of dealing with difficulties in Krishna consciousness. Whatever I'm going through, I fully accept this is my responsibility. If I blame someone else, all I'm doing is actually entangling myself in more karma and more suffering. There's a beautiful story about the Brahmin and the prostitute. Do you know this story? So the Brahmin and prostitute, this Brahmin lived next door to a prostitute. And as her customers were coming, he was so angry. Oh, she's so sinful, so sinful. He decided he would build a wall between their houses. And every time she had a customer coming, he would put a new stone in that wall. So over the years, this wall became very big and separated their houses. So the Brahmin died thinking of that wall. Oh, what a sinful person. He died thinking of all the prostitute's sins. And the prostitute also died thinking of that wall. Oh, what a sinner I am. So the prostitute was liberated and the Brahmin went to hell. So the faults and the reactions of our own sins, these consume the devotee. These are my shortcomings. This is my responsibility. This is the meditation of the devotee, as opposed to thinking, what a terrible thing this person is doing or has done to me. Now, this is a very high ideal, I know, and it's not easy to change our feelings. You know, one of my God brothers, Garuda Prabhu, says that our feelings are the only reality we know. Very interesting point. You know, but when our feelings don't square with our philosophical ideas, what do? We understand intellectually that this is my responsibility, and yet we're mad at the other person. So what do? Any strategies? Any suggestions? There's one really helpful strategy I have learned. It's called the I message. Have you ever heard this? You can separate your feelings from what you want to do about it. So repressing the feelings, we know from Bhagavad Gita, this doesn't help. You know, what can repression accomplish? But to express those feelings in a non-violent way allows us to accommodate the other person's actions. So rather than say a you message, hey, you did this, you stepped on my toe, we say an I message. When you step on my toe, I get very angry. I feel very angry. We express our feelings, but without accusation. And this actually has a wonderful effect. When we tell people how their actions are affecting us, when you say this, I feel this way. It's just a statement of fact. It's neutral. It's a statement of reality. There's no purport. You know, just want you to know that when you act this way or when you did this, I had this reaction. Now, that person has two choices, right? They can say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you feel this way. That was not my intention. Ideally, they're going to respond like that, and then our feelings are assuaged. Or they can say, tough luck. I don't care. That's your problem. Prabhu. In which case we know this is a person, this is a devotee in whom we cannot confide. We do not want to disclose our minds to this person. Because when we do disclose our minds, it doesn't affect them in the way we would like. So therefore we understand this is someone I offer respects to from a distance. This is the beauty of the I message. Good way to respond to negative feelings. So the idea is that we identify the behavior as separate from the person, and we can love the person without endorsing the behavior. This is a kind of forgiveness, you know, a very advanced Vaishnava quality, to be able to forgive. That enables us to accept responsibility. We can't really accept responsibility for our own actions unless we can forgive the other person. So we have to separate their action from themselves. Jayananda Prabhu had this wonderful quality. He would not listen to criticism of other devotees. He would, if people were criticizing someone else, he would either leave or he would say something positive about that person. Have you ever tried that? It's a very powerful technique. Anyone ever experienced that? You hear devotees talking critically about another devotee? No? I guess you are just on such a high platform. Maybe I'm wasting my breath here. You should be instructing me. After all, I come from the country that just elected Donald Trump, so... So he would say something positive. It has an amazing effect. People are criticizing somebody. This actually is Vaishnava aparad, and it hinders our progress. So people are criticizing. We need to leave that place, or we need to say something positive. And that will help mitigate and help people forgive and help people see the person's sincerity. You know, the faults of a devotee are like the pot marks on the moon. Out of this beautiful moonlight personality, there's a few faults. So finding the good qualities is actually not very difficult if we look for them. You know, usually if devotees are doing too much fault finding with one another, they need to go on Sankirtan. Go out on book distribution for a few minutes, an hour or two. And then isn't it? And then it has this amazing effect that, oh, I really want to get back with the devotee. So, tatenu kampamsu shumikshamana, the accepting responsibility, not blaming others, not blaming the agent of our karma. This is mature Krishna consciousness. It just helps us. You know, it doesn't help us to hold a grudge, especially against someone else. Forgiving other people, especially those who've hurt us in some way, actually helps us pass one of those crises that Maharaj is describing in his seminar Friday and Saturday. To be able to forgive, we have to be able to look at the other person, see their valuable qualities, and also think, you know, if I were in their situation, I probably would have done the same thing. There's so many considerations in their life that I don't understand. If I were in their situation, I probably would have done the same thing. If we can adopt this and embrace it and actually internalize these feelings, it relieves us. It relieves our negative feelings. There's no other way to get rid of them. You know, getting revenge is not a good strategy, especially in the association of devotees. You know, to get revenge does not make us feel better. It just makes us feel more angry and sets us up for more suffering. You know, so I mean, just think, if you have a disagreement with somebody and you hold that grudge throughout your life, what is the result of that going to be? What's that? Yes, you'll be unhappy in the course of your life, and then what happens at death? You remember that person, that's right, and then you have to take birth with that person again and continue this dispute. See, so unless we can let go of that anger, we will continue suffering from it on and on and on. It's very difficult sometimes, but these are the kind of difficulties that face us, just like Mother Yashoda was experiencing. You know, it wasn't real easy for her to capture Krishna. And then when she catches him, it wasn't easy for her to tie him up. So the devotee has to know there are going to be challenges in devotional service. We all experience so many unexpected things. One devotee was asking me if I knew why all the GBC members have sloping foreheads and big ears. I said, no. He said, what? Oh, no. The more responsibility we take, the more difficult it is. Yes, it's very difficult. And Srila Prabhupada took so much difficulty for spreading Krishna consciousness. One of our godbrothers, Rabindra Swarup Prabhu, told a story about being in Prabhupada's room one time. You know, we would see Prabhupada's letters. They're always upbeat and encouraging and inspiring. Devotees would share them with one another. They're collected in books. If you read them one after the next, they're all so consistently encouraging. But Rabindra was in Prabhupada's room, and he was alone there, and he couldn't resist. There was a stack of correspondence letters to Prabhupada. So he started looking through the letters. He said, this problem, this problem, this problem. He even said once, don't make me problem pod. But just one difficulty after the next. But Prabhupada would always respond with positive, encouraging words, you know. So the difficulties that the devotees have, actually, that we go through, that actually qualifies us to come closer to Krishna. So first thing is accepting responsibility for my own actions. And then continuing to worship Krishna in the core of one's heart. Tad vag vapu, that with your body and mind, everything, your heart, continuing to serve Krishna with our very soul and with everything we can give. This experience we get in japa. When it's japa, it's right, it's you and Krishna and the beads and the mind. Just the four of us together. And that's when we really test our ability to surrender. That the chanting, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Cheto Darpana Marjanam, it cleanses the heart. So as we chant and chant year after year, on and on, we should become kind of practiced at it, to say the least. Huh? And that practice means that in our heart, when we chant, we are at least in the mood of humility, of respect for the holy name. You know, we may not be in the mood of ecstatic love, but if we are chanting, like on our knees, like begging Krishna for service, you know, that is putting our heart and serving Krishna in a way that is consistent with that verse, tad vag manobhir. That's it, body, words, and mind. In the core of our heart, praying, begging Krishna, please engage me in your service. Getting old is wonderful in Krishna consciousness. You know, it's hellish in material life, but it's wonderful in Krishna consciousness. I'm from Florida, and in South Florida, all the old people, or many old people, like to go and try to relive their youth. And you see them running around on South Beach in bathing suits and bikinis. It's like the world's largest changing bodies exhibit. And it's very instructive for spiritual life, because you see that these people are trying to recapture the only kind of enjoyment they ever knew, that when their bodies were young and they could enjoy them in different ways. And it's so pathetic. But growing old in Krishna consciousness, we just become more ready to pack our bags and go back to Godhead. Even Yudhisthira Maharaj suffers, our sufferings are insignificant by comparison, but they are real sufferings. If it was nice, who'd want to go, right? When the suffering lets up a little bit, we think, okay, it's not so bad. You know, but when We look at our lives as a whole, and as the years go on, all the things that we wanted to do that we couldn't do, and all the things that we tried to do that didn't work out, and all the disappointments, and all the setbacks, and all the pain, all of the things that make this world, that characterize this world, they all become our impetus. Yes, I am done. This lifetime, this is it. No more, never again. And that's a wonderful thing. It gives us more conviction in our chanting. And it gives us more, our only solace becomes the holy name. Only time we can really feel content and complete is when we chant. And so we want to chant more and more. This is a natural progression of life for the devotee. So continuing to call out Krishna in the core, from the core of our heart, this is the other way to respond to difficulties. And finally, to expect Krishna's mercy. In spite, while we recognize the sufferings of this world, we're also very upbeat and optimistic. My mother, who's 97, likes to say, oh, your philosophy is so fatalistic. This world is bad. And indeed, some devotees preach like this, you know. This world is bad. We're in Maya. Any questions? But Prabhupada was always so inspiring because he had this realization, expecting Krishna's mercy. In spite of my suffering, in spite of my shortcomings, I fully expect Krishna's mercy. We may have an idea what Krishna's mercy will look like, and that is a problem. We have a certain expectation. If it goes unfulfilled, then we become disappointed. But Krishna's mercy will come in very wonderful and unexpected ways. And when that happens, it's such a nice experience. What is that story? The Chinese farmer. I'm sure you know this. All know this story. He was there were some wild horses that ran across his farm, and his son was able to capture one. So his neighbors came and said, "Oh, you're so fortunate." He said, "Maybe yes, maybe no." So the son caught the captured horse and took it out to break it, to train it up for work. But the horse was wild and threw him off, and the son broke his leg and couldn't work. And all the neighbors came and said, "Oh, you're so unfortunate. Your son can't help you." "Maybe yes, maybe no." And then the country went to war, and the king's men came to the village and took all the young men to join the army. But the farmer's son couldn't go because his leg was broken. So the neighbors came and said, "Oh, you're so fortunate. You kept your son." "Man, maybe yes, maybe no." So the point is, the devotee does not get emotionally involved in how Krishna's plan is unfolding. It may be something that is very difficult for us to appreciate. Hare Krishna. Krishna's mercy may come for us in a way which is very difficult to appreciate, but we don't lose faith that Krishna has our best interests in mind. When we read about devotees struggling, like Mother Yashoda, we see how if she had her way, things would have been much different. Krishna would have sat patiently while she was taking care of the milk. Krishna would not have undone her work of the morning and broken the butter pot and distributed all the butter to the monkeys. He would have continued nursing very peacefully. Anyone who's ever raised a child knows these things are total fiction. You know, children will create, they learn very quickly how to press the parents' buttons and just make you suffer in so many ways. Test your patience, test your Krishna consciousness, and, you know, they scream during lectures, embarrass you, everything you wish they would do differently. But in spite of all of these setbacks, Mother Yashoda caught Krishna eventually. This is why she's glorified as such a great devotee. It wasn't just easy. Much struggle was there, but she caught him eventually. In the purport here, Prabhupada contrasts the devotee's mind with the yogis and the jnanis. The real thing, the real fundamental difference, you know what it is to me? The difference between a devotee and others is that devotees have the ability to actually transcend selfishness. to some extent or another, to some extent, because we understand the serving mood, it allows us to rise above the ordinary constraints of self-interest. And of course, Prabhupada compared the mother's love for the child, it's the closest thing in this world to selfless love. The mother has that natural ability to sacrifice everything for the child. That's their great glory. Men have a much more difficult time, you know, because men have, our contribution to the world is carrying around the male ego. You know, somebody has to do it. I see, actually, in the Alachua temple, a nice big temple room, and there's big dancing during the Sunday feast kirtan. And you see, on the ladies' side, the ladies are in a very organized way. They're dancing together. They're making lotus flowers open and close, all kinds of artistic moves in a very cooperative way. The men know two kinds of dances. One is a jumping contest, and the other is the circle. And the circle works for the men because every man thinks, I'm leading. So the selfless love of the mother for the child is the closest thing that we can understand in this world to the pure love of a pure devotee. Right? Krishna is more important to me than I am to myself. You know, that is pure devotion. Krishna's pleasure is much more important to me than any other consideration. The yogis and the jnanis cannot experience that because they always have their own motivation in mind. Have you ever met an impersonalist who is acknowledged impersonalist? The characteristic I've noticed about such people is that they always have a certain date on which they realized they were one with the universe. It was June 14th, 2012. I was on top of a mountain and I was one with everything. And then the rest of the time they're thinking, how can I get back to that moment of Brahman realization? It's always about me. The yogis, they also think in terms how much they can progress in their austerity, how much they can stretch their bodies, how much they can increase their renunciation and experience some kind of higher consciousness. But the devotee is able to bypass all that because in the end, it's all about having a relationship with Krishna, a relationship in which we are giving whatever we are able to give to Krishna. And Krishna makes it so easy. You know, patram pushpam palam toyam. This verse in the Bhagavad Gita, it's actually so beautiful, poetic. Patram pushpam palam toyam. Leaf, flower, fruit, and water in that order. Now, what do we see in the early springtime? What appears on the trees? The leaf, right? And then in the summer, the pushpa, the flowers come out. And then in the fall, the fruits. And then in winter, well, at least we can find some snow to melt, right? So in that verse, we see any time of year, under any circumstance, we can find something to offer to Krishna. If we offer it with love, he will accept it. That's very significant. You know, we don't have to be superstars. We don't have to be anyone other than who we are. And Krishna will accept it. There was an incident Satsarupa Maharaj, as a young devotee, asked Srila Prabhupada, what kind of person would Krishna like us to be? And Prabhupada answered in a very interesting way. Anyone know how he answered that question? He said, you are very sincere. And that was it. So what I understand from that exchange was that Prabhupada was saying as if you could be somebody other than who you are. You're so sincere, you're willing to be somebody else, but of course, you can't do that. You are who you are. So we are who we are, and Krishna accepts that, whatever it is. You know, I see this sometimes, this affects devotees. We think we have to be perfect before Krishna will accept us. Nothing could be further from the truth. We just have to be willing to offer whatever we have. You know, there's good days and there's bad days. Whatever we have, we offer that to Krishna. Not, okay, I'm having a bad day. Krishna, I'll get back to you tomorrow. You know, this doesn't work. It doesn't help us. But Krishna, you know, because you see, he knows us better than we know ourselves. There's nothing we can hide from him, right? It's not like he doesn't know what we're thinking or going through, or that we're feeling some attraction to Maya or whatever. He knows all that. So Krishna, here I am with all of my imperfections. I know you accept me. I expect your mercy. Just, you know, I'm sorry, this is all I've got today. Please take it. I burn the chapatis, and it's all I've got. You please take it today. That's all I have to offer you today. It's a burnt chapati day, Krishna, you know. Anyway, you're well aware. Here it is. See you. Tomorrow will be better, I'm sure. This is what it means to expect Krishna's mercy. I'm expecting Krishna's mercy. That whatever faults I have, whatever shortcomings I have, Krishna will accept me. And all I have to do is offer that leaf, flower, fruit, whatever is available. I'll offer whatever I have, and he'll accept that. He's so kind. I had the good fortune to see Srila Prabhupada in Atlanta in 1975. Were you there, Rupa Velasprabhu? He made that visit. You know, Prabhupada gave the shortest arrival address, I think, ever. A lot of us had come from other places, and we were all crammed in this temple room. And they had just finished nailing the Vyasasan together and were hoping it would hold when Prabhupada's car pulled up in the driveway. That was the place where Prabhupada said, "Everywhere I go, it smells like fresh paint." So Prabhupada came in and sat down on the Vyasasana. And he said, "So I've just been to Miami." He said, Miami, Caracas, Mexico City. He said, "But of all the temples, your temple is the best." And we all cheered, although most of us were not from Atlanta. Jive! And the deities at the time were Gornitai. And Prabhupada sat on his Vyasasana looking at these Gornitai deities, looking at this room full of enthusiastic new people in a city where he had never even been. And he said, "So Lord Chaitanya is very kind." He began quoting Parama Karuna Pahundwijan, this bhajan by Lochandas Thakur. Saba Avatar Saro Shiromani Kevala Anandakanda. Their path of self-realization is simply joyful. So he said then, "Krishna demands Sarva Dharmam Parichaja, surrender to me. But Lord Chaitanya does not demand. He's so kind." And then he began just weeping. He said, "So take shelter of Lord Chaitanya and be happy. Thank you very much." That was all he was asking. So this means we can expect, especially by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we can expect Krishna's mercy. You know, nobody could escape the flood of Lord Chaitanya's mercy. He devised tricks and means to drown everybody in that ocean, that flood of love of Godhead. So we are so fortunate to be able to get connection with this glorious Sankirtan movement. If we just do our best to avoid offenses, we can expect Krishna's mercy. And as Prabhupada comments on that verse, my last point, all you have to do is remain in Krishna consciousness. You know, if you are the heir in a will, what is the only qualification you have to inherit that money? You just have to stay alive. So if I can share anything with you after my years in Krishna consciousness, just stay alive no matter what happens. Just keep chanting. There's no reason to leave the association of devotees. There's great benefit in staying in the ISKCON family because you have the most diverse association. You know, there's great benefit in remaining loyal to Prabhupada and just sticking with it no matter what. Sloped head, big ears, whatever. You have to experience. And life just gets sweeter and sweeter. And we get closer and closer to going back to Godhead. And all the purports and all the verses, everything becomes more and more ingrained and realized in our lives. That's the beauty of just staying in Krishna consciousness. If we take responsibility for our actions, we give everything we can to our japa, and we expect Krishna's mercy, then we can stay alive in Krishna consciousness and leave this world for the last time. All right, thank you very much for your kind attention. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. We have a few minutes for questions, anyone, or comments.